version of NPR's Morning Edition that premieres on 91FM March 1st, Saturday, and will be broadcast every Saturday morning from 8 until 10 o'clock. The show is called Weekend Edition, and coming up, we're going to meet the show's host and chief correspondent, Scott Simon, and the show's executive producer, Jay Kernis. They're both probably already familiar to Morning Edition listeners. Jay Kernis was the executive producer of Morning Edition. He's also contributed many interviews with actors, singers, filmmakers, and writers. He's been with NPR for 13 years. In a little while, he'll share a behind-the-scenes view of Morning Edition and of the new show, Weekend Edition. With me now on Fresh Air is Scott Simon, who is considered by many reporters and listeners to be one of broadcast journalism's most sensitive and versatile reporters and one of its best writers. He started off reporting on stories close to his home in Chicago, where he headed NPR's Chicago Bureau. He won a 1979 Major Armstrong Award for his report on the American Nazi Party rally in Chicago. In the last few years, his reporting has taken him around the world. He's recorded in a prison cell with serial murderer Henry Lee Lucas, where Scott asked if killing someone made Lucas feel good. And he's filed from El Salvador while ducking bullets whizzing around him. Scott Simon also has frequently filled in as host of Morning Edition and All Things Considered. The new show he hosts, Weekend Edition, begins on 91FM in March. You can hear it every Saturday from 8 until 10 in the morning. Scott will be interviewing guests from the studio, but he'll also be filing reports from around the country. This is an excerpt of his report from the Rajneesh Purim. He was there the day after the Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh left America. Scott spoke with some of his followers.
Cattle graze on a new green field, below a cliff on top of which the 93 Rolls Royces of Bhagwan Rajneesh have now been parked, each upholstered like summer furniture in a white canvas cover. The commune has announced that the automobiles will be sold over these next few weeks for a reported $5 million, and those who work in the cattle yards are contemplating their own futures now that Bhagwan Rajneesh has left the place centered around him.
If the financial reality is such that this is going to go into a dissolving process, if that happens, I'll be gone. And if it doesn't happen, I'll be here counting the money.
That's not the most spiritual phrase I've ever heard, you know.
I don't know whether that's true or not. I think that money and spirituality, in fact, go together. The whole Christian religion is taught the very opposite, which is why half of the world is starving to death.
I have a beginning to develop a mental understanding that if the Bhagwan Rajneesh got up in a press conference in Nepal now and said, close that place, it's foul, it's counterfeit, shut it down, take my name off, you guys here would say, I wonder what the Bhagwan is saying. That's why we love him so.
Yeah. I mean, he is the sound of one hand clapping.
The Swami, or religious teacher, is Anand Tirtha.
There are 5 billion people on this planet, and most of them are stupid. They're not very intelligent, and they're not going to go anywhere. But there's a small percentage of very intelligent people who can move and can grow.
But to seem to write off most of the planet, that can sound cruel, not loving.
What are you doing with your life? You see, I got to that place, and what I did is I gave up everything and I went to Africa. Mm-hmm. And I went out to feed these starving people. It's hopeless on the mass level. The only way is you got to start with intelligent people. I'm not interested in the masses. I'm interested in just the few people who want to go into a new dimension. That's the unknown. I think that's what Bhagwan is about.
That was a report filed by Scott Simon at the Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh commune, the Rajneesh Purim, and that report was filed for Weekend Edition, which will be featuring Saturday mornings from 8 until 10. Scott Simon, welcome to Fresh Air. Yeah. We've heard a lot of your reports on Morning Edition and All Things Considered, and we've just heard a sample of what the kind of work you're doing for Weekend Edition. What's the difference to you between weekend and weekday?
Well, yeah, you get to sleep in for most of the week comparatively, but I shouldn't be flip. I think the difference between the two shows is people will notice it. First, I want to say it's similar in the sense that the latest, most up-to-the-minute reliable information on news stories will be there and be available. That being said, we are a weekly show, and we're going to approach special topics and subjects which interest us. We're going to do profiles of people who intrigue us, as we did about your own city of Philadelphia's Trevor Farrell a couple months ago. And I think those things will, those reports will be done in a way, firstly, that is sometimes longer, although not necessarily. Sometimes it'll be shorter than what's available on Morning Edition. But I think also there'll be a different tone. There'll be a little bit more narrative. The storytelling aspects of relating a story will be there because we are not a daily news show. And we can take a little bit more time and approach it from a different perspective.
You're such a good writer and spend so much, well, pay so much care to the writing you do for the radio that I bet a lot of people have asked you, how come you're not in print? Because you're writing so good, and that's not to make light of your radio production skills at all. But have you ever written, have you ever considered print journalism or done that?
Yeah, I have done both, and I still do occasional magazine articles. Yes, I began in this business as a print reporter, although I can't say my writing was very... This is an interesting point. Yes, I began as a print reporter in journalism at a newspaper called the Montreal Star, which is now dead. And I didn't... Yet I wasn't much of a writer there. I mean, I perhaps the ability would have been about the same as it is now, although not, you know, things that you learn as you go along, experience, tone, judgment, all that sort of thing. But the kind of writing we do on National Public Radio, the best of it, is not being done by most newspapers in this country, which is just a sad fact. I think the Philadelphia Inquirer here in this city is a very well-written newspaper. I could mention five or six more in this country, but for the most part, the kind of writing we're talking about in journalism, I think, frankly, has deteriorated in this time, where it has become not as involving, not as first person, not as engaging. The use of language isn't as interesting. And so that kind of work is not being done in newspapers. There are a few magazines that do it, but not even many of those.
Well, certainly for the time being, you've decided to stick with radio and give most of your time to that as opposed to the page. What are some of the aspects of reporting for radio that you feel you really can't get into a newspaper?
Sense of immediacy. You just heard a small portion of it. The dialogue I had with a man named Swami Tirtha, who is, I don't know actually his status now, obviously, sort of the head religious teacher of the commune of the Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh in Rajneeshpuram in Oregon, where he says to me, "What are you doing with your life?" That can't be captured so much in print. And my absolute stupefaction being caught short for an answer. The sense of immediacy and drama that you can have in dialogue. And where radio is very good, I think people overestimate the amount of graphic information that can be imparted on television, as a matter of fact. I think television producers have convinced themselves if they show a picture of something, the audience has seen it and the audience understands it, which in my experience, and I have also worked in television, is not true at all. Unlike a still photograph, the image you get in a video display is often not directed, and there's often not a lot of depth of information that's imparted. In radio, oddly enough, we can do that. The sound of something allows you to concentrate with your words on what something looks like, and people can create a pretty good mental image in their mind, which approximates what you saw, and then the sound of it can place them there.
You've been to several countries where there's been packs of reporters, and I'm thinking especially of El Salvador and trying to cover Grenada. When you're in what's becoming a packed situation and you have friends there who are print reporters and TV reporters and radio journalists, what are some of the things that you think you'd be going after that your colleagues, say, in print or TV wouldn't?
Conversation. The sense of immediate dramatic conversation that you have with a single person. Print reporter has something of an advantage, particularly those of them that don't take notes very scrupulously, and I understand sometimes there's a reason for that. But they can hear somebody say something in an offhand manner that's not part of a formal interview, and they can write it down. It's perfectly fair game as long as the person knows that it's fair game and they might be quoted. That's something you can't do with the need to put a microphone in front of somebody's face, obviously. So I think a radio reporter looks for involving conversation that can carry a story, can look for the sound of something which will engage a listener. And I think that's what you need to do to be able to deliver the information most effectively. Print reporters can best speak for themselves, I think, obviously, but the print medium more likely lends itself sometimes to complicated, involved explanations of material that the rest of us on radio or television, for that matter, would probably take care of in a sentence or two. We would say something like, the gross national product of Turkey is increasing, whereas a print reporter might be actually able to explain to you how it has been increasing. And, you know, when it's – of course, we would need to do that sometimes in radio as far as that goes. But if that's not part of the central story, we are more likely to go for the human involving moments of a story.
There's a report that you did for Morning Edition that I want to play that I think is a great example of something that worked fabulously on radio, and I can't imagine how it would have come across in print. And it was such a great story, and I doubt anyone covered it. And I'm thinking of an interview you did with the voice of Radio Grenada.
Edwin Frank.
Yeah.
This was the young man who was on duty. Their morning drive time, insofar as Grenada has a drive time, their morning drive time announcer the morning of the invasion, as a matter of fact. And I went back to find him a year after the invasion.
Now, why did that story appeal to you so much? I bet not a lot of journalists went to find him and do an interview with him a year later.
I heard the tape. The sound of him on the morning of the invasion was something I couldn't get out of my mind. Now, of course, the morning that Grenada was invaded, I was at home abed in Chicago. None of us knew the invasion was coming. And it wasn't until I got to Grenada, actually Barbados, later that night, that one of the students coming off the island had given me a cassette. He just put it in you know, what amounts to his little, his tape recorder, Walkman, whatever he was using. In any event, he thought this was dramatic too, and he gave me the cassette, and I couldn't get over it. It was amazing. You will, I guess, hear his voice, Edwin Frank's voice, on the morning of the invasion, but the sense of terror and apprehension and foreboding, and I think we often forget that it was an almost inconceivable event that anybody would invade Grenada. So that's all very conveyed very effectively in his voice. And I guess, secondly, I felt a sense of identification with him. You know, because I had the same job, but I was on in the mornings too at that particular point, and I felt something for him. I'd never, as a reporter, I'd covered wars, but I had never, as a host, had to cover an invasion that was happening in my backyard, and I was trying to imagine how I would do that. And I actually admired his relative sense of poise. Now, the words are—I mean, he was just reading a script that was put in his hands by the Hudson Austin government at that point. I don't think you'd call it honest, forthright reporting, but he has a sense of composure, and one is moved by what he has to do. You know, he was a pro who kept on doing the job.
Well, why don't we listen to that report? And this is with the Voice of Grenada, a report filed by Scott Simon.
Grenadians, our country is now under attack. At 5:40 this morning, foreign troops began landing in our country. Our armed forces are engaging them in fierce battle. All Grenadians report immediately to our respective militia bases. All doctors, nurses, and medics report to the hospital immediately.
I left to try to cover that military intervention on the morning it was announced, and I remember that night, having been able to reach only as far as Barbados, I heard a tape of the morning's broadcast on Radio Free Grenada, heard that announcer read, then repeat bulletins, orders, and simple pleas. The quaver in his voice, the urgency, the loneliness of that single unnamed voice, speaking alone, it seemed, against an unidentified invasion. The next day, we reporters were told that the studios of Radio Free Grenada had been destroyed. And I wondered about that voice, wondered, most simply and importantly, if the man who'd broadcast that plea was dead or alive.
So it was like speaking in the wilderness and people cursing you, and one was conscious of the fact that people are there. The listeners were not taking seriously what was being said, but I think the nature of and the tenseness of the period really meant that one had to obey. If not, it could have meant something really different. Probably life and death, who knows?
He is alive. I returned just last night from a few days' reporting trip to Grenada, and I searched out for the man who was the voice of Radio Free Grenada that day, Edwin Frank. American occupation forces and the Grenadian interim government have prohibited him from remaining in radio. But the 30-year-old Mr. Frank, after 9 months of enforced unemployment, is now a statistical typist at Grenada's Office of Tourism. And he said that on the morning of the American invasion, members of the People's Revolutionary Government had typed out his speech for him to repeat, saying the survival of the Grenadian nation rested with him.
The Grenadian people have asked to block all roads and obstruct the enemy's progress. Block all roads and obstruct the enemy's progress.
Why do you think the people of Grenada didn't heed your words? Why do you think they didn't rise up and oppose the invasion and didn't use their cars to block the roads?
Well, I think it's quite obvious. After coming out of the most terrible experience one could ever even dream of on October 19th, the small size of Grenada, the fact that everybody knows each other, and the fact that many people died
yeah.
on the fort that day, there was no way you could have gotten people to respond positively to that kind of call.
Do you miss radio?
I had loved it, in fact. I don't even believe the people who were responsible for taking me away from the radio were very happy in doing so, but the fact is that I might have committed what some might call character suicide, on the morning of the presentation, in that I was doing things which, when they calculated, in fact, came out to mean that it was against the interests of the people and whatnot. Mm-hmm. You know, one can decide what I am, but in the eyes of some, I'm a wicked person.
The former voice of Radio Free Grenada, Edwin Frank, who's now a statistical typist at the Bureau of Tourism in St. George's.
Well, this is Morning Edition. I'm Edwin Frank.
One of the things I really like about that story is how it captured the loneliness of somebody in a radio station while this invasion is happening around them. People think that radio is right in the center of things, and it can be very lonely inside there.
Oh, yeah. I felt an inescapable sense of identification with him, because you wonder what would happen if you, not less if it would happen in Washington, but what if somehow magically you had been on duty at Radio Free Grenada that morning? What would you have done?
My guest is Scott Simon, and you'll be able to hear him every Saturday morning now. We're carrying a new show beginning Saturdays in March called Weekend Edition that's similar to Morning Edition, and you can hear it Saturday mornings from 8 until 10 o'clock. You really got your start in radio doing a lot of, what's called human interest type stories. And it seems to me that you've applied the kind of humanism that you had for those reports to news stories that you do, and to, you know, stories of international significance that you do. Do you think of it as that way too?
Yeah, sometimes I do. As a matter of fact, I mean, yes, consciously I've done that because that's what I know how to do. I hope I do the other kind of reporting too, and that I can do the other kind of reporting. But I know as a listener, that kind of reporting had never struck me as sufficient. I wanted to know more. I was in El Salvador once. I think the piece person I remember meeting, therefore piece I remember doing sometimes more than any other, was a profile I did of a dentist in the outback of El Salvador. It was a Red Cross dentist. He was the most remarkable man, and he went around with a Red Cross. He pulled teeth. He didn't fill any cavities. It wasn't that kind of dentistry. But you really got a sense of the war and what it had cost that country by traveling around with him. And, of course, the tape of that report is filled with sounds of him tapping on somebody's teeth, and then you hear teeth coming out by the roots, and of course it's just a painful thing to listen to, but there's also bombs in the background. This is man is pulling teeth while the bombs are exploding. And at one point he gestures for a microphone to come in closer, and he says, if you ask me, we don't need more bombs, we need more medicine. And I think the contours of an event like a civil war can sometimes be most effectively suggested by the actual human experience of the people who were caught up in it.
Well, speaking of human experience, you had a few of your own while you were in El Salvador. I remember at least one report where I think you were filing on the elections, and there were bullets all around you, and I was worried about you.
Yeah, and my there's a funny story about actually the first time that happened. Pardon me.
No, go ahead.
Oh, the first time that happened, I know the day you're in a town called Apopa, we came under fire during one of the Salvadoran elections. But what I'm remembering is it was a time, I guess, it was time before that, come to think of it. When I was there a couple of years before that, my producer and I, who was then not Jay Kernis, but a woman named Kimberly Conroy, were walking towards a battle that was occurring on the street about two blocks up, and we began to walk towards it. And rebel soldiers and government soldiers were firing at each other. And in any event, we were walking down the street to try and get closer to see what was going on, and they began to fire shots at us. Tape recorder was rolling, but we took refuge behind, I guess you'd call it a staircase, about a stoop of about six stairs. And, well, the story I'm getting to is when we came under fire, I recorded a news spot. And eventually the firing diminished a little bit, and we chanced it because we figured we had to get back and file or else you're not doing your job. So we filed this news spot, and in any event, it was on the air. And John Hockenberry was in our evening newscaster, and he said something like, NPR Scott Simon under fire in El Salvador. I've never heard the exact tape, but my mother heard that on the air that night, and she called up the number I had given her in case she wanted to contact somebody, and in fact she got John Hockenberry in the newsroom, and she said, "Hi, I'm Scotty's mother, and look, I know I promised that I wouldn't call him, but I mean, you know, I just heard the report, and I just, can you tell me, is he dead or is he alive?" And John, to his credit as a newsman, didn't want to crawl out in any limbs until he was absolutely certain, said, "Hang on, I'll find out." And my mother says that she was put on hold for about 2 minutes, and all the time she kept thinking, you know, oh, my God, they're there saying, why didn't somebody call his mother? Why didn't somebody call his mother? Of course, I was absolutely fine. But in any event, I hope it would be a bigger story than the fourth piece on the newscast if I wasn't. But in any event, I was fine. But so I sort of experienced that secondhand because I knew I was fine. Nobody had told my mother, though.
But had you ever gone through wondering how you would behave if you were under fire in a story? Because until you'd started doing this international reporting, you wouldn't have known. Were you satisfied with your performance? Did you behave in the manner you wanted to?
Yeah, I think for the most part. I had been through some instances of domestic riot and disturbance in Chicago, riots in a place called Humboldt Park and in Marquette Park. So I had been in situations where you needed to take care physically. I think the first time I came under fire, there were three of us, my engineer and myself and my producer, and we all had a different range of reactions. You either cry or you laugh or lose control of your bodily functions, and we all had different reactions. I am a laugher. And in fact, I think somewhere on somebody's outtake reel, there's some wonderful tape of me trying to get my way through the news spot, which I'm ad-libbing and laughing. I can't explain why. It's, you know, nervous energy. You're operating at a particularly high pitch. I guess I would rather be a laugher given that, you know, given those range of options. But I was pleased that I was able to go ahead and do the job, that I looked around me and I had concern for my physical well-being or else you can't get the piece back. But on the other hand, I still took notes and tried to notice what I could.
Did you find that there was, on the part of some reporters, any bravado or grandstanding to show how tough they could be under fire and in war circumstances?
Yeah. There's a man who became a friend of mine in a wary way, a man named John Hoagland, who was a photographer for Newsweek. And this happens to a lot of people who have that bravado. John was killed about a year and a half ago, shortly before I went down for my third visit there. There becomes a cult. Those people are sometimes called cowboys, and they seem to put more premium on doing that kind of work than others. There are some people that will accept the risks as a certain part of the job, and then there are other people that think the risks are the job. That group tends to become photographers, as a matter of fact, more than do radio correspondents, so I think it goes both ways. And I don't mean to single John out, because he was a fine photographer and did a lot of good work, but on the other hand, I think when he was killed, the common reaction was among people, those of us who knew him in the press corps, was that was an accident that was waiting to happen. And I was not of that variety. But, there were some stories that are worth that physical hazard, others that aren't. And I think, you know, when we went up to see bombing in Guazapa in the area north of the volcano, that was a story that was important and it was worth the physical hazard. Just another battle down the road probably is not. And I think what happens is after a while, when you know you're entering hazardous territory, well, you take some precautions, at least mentally. You're ever vigilant for that. When it's just another story, you're not as vigilant as you should be, and you're more likely to run into something which you'll regret.
When you returned to the States, and you know, especially when you were guest hosting Morning Edition a lot, did you go through a period of feeling, well, this is anticlimactic, I'm doing interviews and I'm not...
interviewing
not under fire anymore.
Absolutely, interviewing people like Robin Leach, the host of
Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous.
Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. Had I done that interview with him before I'd ever done any of that, it might have been different. Not that I think it would probably be a great show under any circumstance, but I was particularly struck while sitting there and interviewing him of the kind of mindlessness of that show, frankly, shows like that. And I became very sensitive as to that kind of mindless reflex that was in a lot of American culture that I saw, you know, people talking about the $4.5 million golden laid bathtub and that sort of thing. I think I did go through that. What's necessary to recognize, you can't become physically dependent on that kind of jolt of adrenaline, because that's unhealthy and that's bad and that warps your values as much as Robin Leach kind of programming does. He doesn't listen to the show, does he? In any event, we'll find out. In any event, that can be as warping. So you have to settle that in your own mind and recognize that it's, you know, because, you know, there's the other part of me is that I can have fun interviewing someone like Robin Leach as well. There's that part of me which enjoys that kind of thing, maybe not in the same way he does. In any event, I think you need to reach a sense of equilibrium within your own mind as to how you're going to live. I think if you make that kind of reporting your trade, you lose a sense of perspective after a while, and you lose a sense of the things to appreciate in life.
Now, I want to play another interview that you did, and this is just a one-on-one interview. There's a long report that precedes it that we won't have time to hear. But this is an interview that I think everybody probably asks themselves, how would I handle it if I was doing an interview with a serial murderer, someone who murdered 360 people, allegedly. That's how many crimes he confesses to. And it was Henry Lee Lucas. Before we hear this short clip, can you tell us a little bit about the strategy that you decided to take when you knew you'd be alone with him and you'd have a finite amount of time to talk with him on tape?
I had an hour. I had talked to the two people I knew of who had interviewed him before. Interviews with him are very difficult to come by. One is a man named Hugh Ainsworth, who'd then done the interview for, I'm afraid, Penthouse Magazine. He was then a freelancer, now works for the Dallas Times Herald, if I'm not mistaken. The other person was a woman named Cynthia Gorney with the Washington Post. And I said to them, you know, what does he like to interview? I did have that advantage. And they both said, you know, that he doesn't like to be challenged. They said that he, you know, he said, well, if you don't believe what I'm saying, well, I'm not going to do this interview anymore. It's over. And so I was very aware of that. And one thing I became aware, because what I thought was I would just say, sit down and say, tell me your story. And then I would follow up with some questions. That was my game plan. I'd read everything about him that I could. I'd gone through all the material. And, you know, as my time goes by in this business, I understand the problem that President Reagan is supposed to have had in that first debate with Walter Mondale, where they said he had too much information. There was information overload, so we had sort of lost sight of his moral purpose. That's sort of what you can feel when you do too much reading. You don't have time to think these things through and realize what is it that really engages your curiosity. So I made a point of just not touching the material the night before, and try and come to it fresh when we drove out there in the morning. And in any event, as soon as I got in the cell and we began the interview, I realized this isn't going to work. Because if you have someone that's going along giving this detailed litany of people that he murdered, it's different for radio than it is for print. At some point in radio, because you are the audience's surrogate, at some point you have to come in and say, wait a minute, why did you do that? That was an innocent woman you killed. And you need to do that. And yet I needed to do it in a way that wouldn't shut him off. I needed to do it in a way that would keep him talking. And that was the difficult thing.
Let's hear an excerpt of how you handled it. And this was a report filed by Scott Simon.
Henry Lee Lucas was born 48 years ago in Blacksburg, Virginia, as far back into the hills as you can get, he told us. His mother was a prostitute who, he says, had sex with her clients in front of her children and her crippled husband. He was also beaten by his parents frequently and needed to steal from an early age simply to eat and buy clothing. Much of this has been confirmed by the psychologists and law enforcement officers, but they also caution that Henry Lee Lucas lies a good deal. We interviewed him there in the Williamson County Jail with no confidence that he would tell us the truth, but a hope that anything he had to say about himself could be an insight into why he did what he did. Henry Lee Lucas says he was 14 when he committed his first murder, a 14-year-old girl he didn't know.
It was a sexual killing. I was experimenting with sex. And after I experimented with it, I was afraid she'd go and tell her mother and her dad or something, and I ended up strangling her to death.
Had you had sex with her?
No, I tried, but I never did.
It wouldn't work, or what?
Not for me. I just wasn't interested, really.
Would killing somebody make you feel good?
No.
Make you feel anything?
I didn't feel nothing. It's like being two people. I could see myself committing the crime, but I couldn't feel myself committing it.
You sometimes did more than just kill people.
Most of the time, yeah.
What would you do?
The bodies would be mutilated as a sacrifice, more or less.
Sacrifice?
Yeah.
To
Satan.
What would you do to the bodies?
Remove sexual organs, put markings on the bodies, cut the bodies up, burn the bodies. It was all done as a sacrifice to Satan.
You didn't believe in Satan.
I live Satan. I don't know what you're talking about. Don't believe in it. I lived it.
What was in you that made you kill people?
Hatred.
You hated the people you killed?
I hated human life.
You didn't know the people you killed?
No.
So how could you hate them?
It's like two people living in your body.
And the one that used to commit those murders is dead now?
I hope. I hope he is. But like I say, I'm not making no guarantees.
That was Henry Lee Lucas in conversation with NPR's Scott Simon, and Scott is the host of the new show, Weekend Edition. Now, you could have done that interview by saying, come on, tell me now, how many people did you murder? Why did you do it? That prosecutorial tone, it would have made you sound like a really tough interviewer. Talk about bravado, that's one way of really getting it. Do you find that that kind of approach doesn't work?
I had a sense it wouldn't work with him. Maybe with some people it does. That tends not to be my approach, although I've done it occasionally. You will, on our show in a few weeks, you will hear a piece that we did from the INS Detention Center in Harlingen, Texas, and I think you will. It's ironic that I probably didn't give this civil servant who runs the detention center the same kind of breaks verbally that I gave that I gave the serial killer Henry Lee Lucas, but in a funny way. Well, you know, he's a fully formed human being who can answer for his record, and I'm afraid with Lucas you had to use some stratagems to get him to. The whole idea was to get him to tell the story and not to get up and say the interview was over.
You've been in the position of having to interview bureaucrats and having to interview diplomats and politicians whose job it is to tell you as little as they could possibly get away with. Mm-hmm. And one of the techniques used by people in that position is frequently to be so boring that no one's paying attention anyways, and they could say whatever they want to or just gloss over the issues. Do you have any strategies for dealing with people who are trying to make trying to blur the issues and not tell you anything, and they're dull? How do you get something from someone like that?
If someone's determined to be dull, it's very difficult. A couple of things you can do is sometimes just say, look, this isn't working. You're really not stating it as effectively as I know you can, Mr. or Miss So-and-so.
You're live on the air now, say.
If you're live on the air, I would be more reluctant to do that. Although I wouldn't rule it out. I mean, when I've done some stuff live on the air, I will say, I don't think we're getting to the question, or I don't think that you're answering the question that I asked, or something like that. That doesn't guarantee that they'll give you the answer. What it does guarantee is that you sort of made a watermark with your audience, that they understand that you're after something that this person won't provide. Another thing you can do on tape but can't do live is to sometimes not say anything. People abhor silence, and bureaucrats in particular, and if you don't say anything, chances are they'll rush to fill it. And if they rush to fill it enough, sometimes they'll say what you want to get to because they've run out of deceptions, and they might actually get to the truth.
Now, I have heard that you have been made offers by television stations, and some of your colleagues at NPR have indeed gone to ABC or CBS.
CBS. Big one, yeah.
Are you not interested in television?
Oh, sure. I mean, at some level. I did a public TV documentary a couple of years ago, which won an Emmy, which nobody saw because it was on opposite the Super Bowl. I mean, no one saw it. I didn't see it. My own mother didn't see it, as a matter of fact. So it was called The Patterson Project. But none of the offers I've gotten from television have been as fun or as respectable as what I'm doing now. So I just, the only thing attractive about it has been the salary. And I'm still not at, I mean, if I was married and had two children about to have either orthodontia or go to college, then that would be different. Everybody has to make their own decision. But since that's not the case, I don't feel the need to go for that money.
You must be very, very busy doing the number of interviews that you do and then traveling as much as you do to file from other places. On the air, you're really just known for your sensitivity and the humanism that informs your reports. Do you find that in your personal life it's sometimes hard to have that sensitivity because you're so busy, you know, preparing what you're doing?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I do. As a matter of fact, I'm sure there were people. Yes, I'm sure there were people who will furnish information to the fact that I seem to be studiously sensitive on the air, and I don't feel that need in personal company quite so much. I mean, I hope I'm thoughtful and respectable. Jay Kernis, my executive producer, is in the control room. Is it hokey? Can I look back? Am I reasonably sensitive off the air? What else can he say? He's blowing kisses through the. Yes, it is sometimes a bit of a chore because in different company you don't feel the need to be that way all the time. I hope I'm not presenting myself as a Jekyll and Hyde character because I don't think I'm that way. I think people would tell me that I'm that way. But yeah, it's a problem sometimes, particularly because I think it is the natural tendency to measure yourself against the person that you hear on the air. And if I'm not as sensitive and as searching and as humane as the person I hear on the air, I think, oh, my God, am I a louse?
When you start to feel that the work is taking too much away from the personal life, mm-hmm. do you think of that as being a temporary condition?
Yeah, I do. I've seen people who reach that stage where it's more serious, where it becomes a permanent affliction that they have to do something about, and I haven't reached that stage yet. But yes, occasionally you feel that there is just nothing left to give and that you're ignoring parts of your personal life which are not indulgent or frivolous but really need to be addressed, you know, things like laundry and going to church and keeping up friendships. And it got very bad for me, I guess it was a couple of months ago when I realized it was so busy. There was an old friend who called me who was out of work, who wanted to do some freelance work for NPR, and I had to be very short with her on the phone because there were lots of things to do. And I felt badly about that because I thought, you know, this is not the kind of person I want to be. This is not the kind of person who takes a phone call from an old friend and say, listen, I love you, baby. I can't talk to you now. I'll have one of the producers here talk to you. Ciao. I don't want to be that kind of person. And when that happens, you have to call a halt. But that hasn't happened for a few weeks because my executive producer is very wise in the way he parcels me out so that I don't feel inundated that way.
Well, I wish you the best with your new program, and I thank you very much for sharing some of your work and your thoughts with us today. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
My guest has been Scott Simon, who is the host of the new program, Weekend Edition, that we'll be carrying Saturday mornings from 6, that is from 8 until 10 in the morning, beginning in March. Now, I'm sure you also know him from the many reports that he's produced for Morning Edition and All Things Considered, and he's also served as guest host for Morning Edition. Well, coming up, we're going to meet the executive producer of Weekend Edition, Jay Kernis, who designed the show along with Scott Simon. And Jay was also one of the creators of Morning Edition. He started out as a senior producer of Morning Edition and then was promoted to the executive producer of the show. When he started the show, it was really a trial by fire because just as the show started, the Iranian hostage crisis story broke. While most of Jay's work with Morning Edition has been behind the scenes, he's also contributed many interviews with singers, actors, directors, filmmakers, and writers. He virtually grew up at NPR, where he's worked for the past 13 years. I spoke with him a little earlier today, and we were talking about some of the differences between Weekend Edition and Morning Edition.
Last summer, when we were asked to come up with a new show, Scott and I, we knew we had to create the sixth day of Morning Edition. Morning Edition, as you know, is a Monday through Friday show. So on Saturday morning, it would be the logical sixth day. But my feeling was that I love Morning Edition. I was there from the beginning, but I was never convinced. I am not convinced.